on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
And thank you very much to the two Johnnies. It is Monday, the 11th of April. This is Game On. Coming up today, Gary Murphy on a masterful win for Scotty Scheffler at Augusta on Sunday, where Rory McIlroy rolled back the years.
Bunker to bunker. This is impossible. Anything's possible.
It was magic to watch such a pro be delighted. A fluke and something. I thought just those pure amateurs did that. But Alan Cawley is in studio to unpack the Man City-Liverpool game that kept the title race very much alive.
Alexander-Arnold, Salah. In for Sadio Mane! What a start to the second half for Liverpool. 47 seconds and Jurgen Klopp is celebrating and Pep Guardiola cannot believe what he's seen.
As well as that, we will have Stephen Ferris on the likely filling of the Munster head coach vacancy and the Champions Cup weekend that was.
Game on 2FM.
If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FN. Damien, it was an incredible weekend of sport. Grand National, Augusta, soccer, rugby. What stood out for you?
I was going to say the misfortune, but it wasn't the misfortune. I was working yesterday at the women's rugby, so I missed Liverpool against Manchester City, which would have been the thing that I was glued to all weekend. And then I drove back up the road and I listened to the Masters on the app. Have you checked out the Masters app?
Oh, I'm watching it all day. It's incredible.
The Masters app is, by a considerable stretch, the greatest sporting app in the world. And I will challenge any man, woman or child that tries to dispute that with me.
I do not disagree. I was even watching replays of it today and I was watching it through the weekend in Liverpool. It is an incredibly simple way of staying in touch with such a massive sporting occasion. But I must say the fact that when I sat on the couch last night and in the bottom right-hand corner, Rory McIlroy's and Shane Lowry's name were there in the top five, it kept me glued to it all night. Even though you knew, Scotty Scheffler was home and hosed, I just thought it was incredible to watch Rory and Shane still be there. Rory to deal, or Shane even, to deal with the triple bogey on the fourth and to grind his way back into it. And watching Rory play with the imagination of old, I was just wishing they'd show more of the two of them. I didn't want to watch Scotty Scheffler.
And then, in a way, I feel sorry in a way for Sky, because Sky gets savaged on Twitter by a whole load of, you know, golf-mad Irish people going, why aren't you showing us Rory McIlroy? Why aren't you showing us Shane Lowry? And sure, they've no control over it because they're getting the pictures from whoever it is the host broadcaster over in the States. It's a brilliant weekend from an Irish perspective. If you shelve the unrealistic expectation of expecting an Irish guy to win these week in, week out. Let's be honest, it was over as a tournament. Will I even say Friday evening? It was definitely over as a tournament on Saturday evening. So do we commend Rory for a phenomenal round, 64 round of the week? Not many fellas will ever go round Augusta 8 under par in a round. Or do we start to question, well, why couldn't you have done that Thursday, Friday?
I think we'll talk to Gary Murphy about it. I think there's a hell of a lot more to it than just that. I did love his own interview, where he said that he was playing out of the last bunker, hoping to get down in two and it goes in. But his comment on the 13th, when he got the eagle on 13 and he thought he could post an unbelievable score, it was then that the birdie seemed to dry up. But look, we'll talk to Gary Murphy about that. I thought the Grand National was fabulous. Great win for Emmett Mullins even. Sam and Robert Whaley-Cohn as well. And Liverpool, Manchester City. Oh, can't wait to talk to Alan Cawley.
Yeah.
That was a game of two halves, that was.
But come here, you know that people go on incessantly, some people go on incessantly about the Premier League. It's the greatest league in the world. And to be honest with you, okay, it's good when it's good, but it's not the greatest league in the world week in, week out. But that yesterday, that is the match to put on a DVD to present to somebody and say, this is what the Premier League is capable of when two teams come out. It was just phenomenal. Is the league over?
No, definitely not. Definitely not over. A couple of Champions Cup games not over either. I'd say Leinster were happy to get back on the bus with a lead against Connacht, but they'll fancy themselves in the RDS. I'm not sure how Munster got out of Devon with the scoreline they had, and obviously Ulster a red card. We'll talk to Stephen Ferris about that, but they must be chuffed to have left to lose with a win.
Yeah, the second round of Leinster Connacht live here on 2FM this Friday. It's a 5:30 kickoff on Good Friday, so the programme on air at 5:25 until full time and around 7:30. The other most exciting thing about it for the weekend is I didn't go into the weekend thinking that I didn't think all three ties would still be alive. I was convinced that one of them would be a turkey shoot. I'm not going to say which one, but when you look at Munster with the injuries they had, Leinster with what it is they're capable of doing, Ulster having to go to Toulouse, it's just brilliant that here we are with this new format, the aggregate scores over the two legs, that everyone is still alive to fight another day, that you don't have a dead rubber this weekend.
No, when you look at the eight of those matches, Damien, obviously Racing have a good lead over Stade. La Rochelle have fancied themselves against Bordeaux, leading 31-13 now. Montpellier, Harlequins, that was a strange one. And obviously Clermont and Leicester are 19 in front there. They might be true. Mm. So still plenty of those games alive.
Now, come here, talk to me about Aintree. Was it agonising? I felt so sorry for you sitting in the truck. Now, we all saw the pictures a couple of weeks ago from Cheltenham where you were screaming Rachel Blackmore on to make history at the end. Let's get on the psychologist's couch for a second. What was it like to watch the latter stages of the greatest race in the world and your old man has the horse, which is, ninth last year, in the mix right until the very end? Like, I felt so sorry for you because you must have been conscious of the fact that every aspect of your facial expressions was being analysed so much in those latter stages.
I wish I had remembered that, Damien. But look, obviously any second now was third last year and very unlucky, and Dad got him back to Aintree in incredible form. And yeah, I guess I was hoping for him he'd go and win. Like, he's my father, but he's probably my best friend as well. Mm. And I thought he'd done an incredible job with him, for a man that trained so few racehorses, to land back to the biggest race with the favourite and go so close. Yeah, I was good of him. That said, I know him at Mullen since he was probably 10 years of age. He was around that age when I started working for Willie, and what he's done in such a short space of time as a trainer is incredible too. So,
and, do you know,
hats off to him. Obviously, blood is thicker than water, and yeah. It did. I was gutted for my dad.
Yeah, and
but when you look at it now, it's time moves on. Yeah. What an achievement for him.
And Nina was on the radio with the lads on Saturday Sport on Saturday afternoon, and she sounded equally brokenhearted when she, they came to her straight after the race. People talk about Any Second Now just being a national horse. 10 years of age, is there the potential to go back again and try and go one step further?
Oh, 3 11-year-olds have won it in the last 10 years, so of course he can go back. It'll really depend on what the handicapper does, and you're trying to bring a horse back to the same peak. We have fourth time for him. Obviously he won in Cheltenham in 2018, 2019 the national was called off, and my years are probably wrong. 2021 he was third, 2022 he was second, 2020 there was no national, and 2019 he won at the Cheltenham Festival. So look, he's a wonderful horse, but it's easy to say about your own old man, but I think he's done a fabulous job with him.
Okay, it's a remarkable story. You look at, Sam Whaley-Cohn announced in advance this is going to be the swan song, and then you go out by winning the race that every jockey in the world measures his career against, irrespective of what it is you've achieved. Like, what a way to go out. What a way to be able to decide this is it.
And what a career for someone who is a proper amateur, Damien. I mean, he owns a dental practice or dental company. He does ride for fun, but like, he's ridden a King George winner on long run, a Gold Cup winner on long run, he's ridden 7 winners over the Grand National fences, he's now won a Grand National. It's an incredible achievement for somebody that is genuinely an amateur. It is part time for him. We have a lot of amateur jockeys in this country, but they work solely in horses. They ride for fun, but their job is with horses every day of the week. Sam Whaley-Cohn's job is in an office. So it is an incredible feat for a true amateur, and he's a lovely guy, and you'd wish him all the best, and what a way to bow out.
But it is the ultimate romance story, because by all accounts, this is a fella who's a multimillionaire and doesn't need to do this for the attention or whatever else, just does it from a genuine love of the sport.
A love and passion. It's like people playing golf or Sunday league soccer or whatever it is. He obviously has the means that he can partake at that level, but he also then has to have the commitment and the skill to go with it. And Damien, when you listen to his interview 35 maybe what a minute after the Grand National on Saturday, he sounded as fit as any professional, or fitter than some of the professional jockeys when he went to give his interview. He didn't, there wasn't a blow out of him. Mm. And I think that's the biggest compliment I can give him.
The interview with Emmett Mullins, which went out as well, which I think like effectively had just stood in the middle of the crowd and watched the race. And I don't think people around him knew who it was that he was, and that this is all unfolding. And by all accounts, certainly in the immediate aftermath, appeared to be the most relaxed, chilled out man in Aintree.
I'd say that was emotional. I'd say he didn't want to talk for what emotion would have poured out. He probably wasn't able to talk. Look, I see him a couple of mornings a week. He trains on the same gallop as Willie, and it's incredible what he's achieving. He had a winner last year at the Cheltenham Festival with the Shunter. They set out a plan with Noble Yates himself and Paul Byrne, who originally owned Noble Yates, that this was going to be the horse's target for the year. Paul obviously sold him to the Whaley Cones back in kind of February time. But a marvellous piece of planning. But I'd say Emmett was lost for words, and probably that emotion that if he started talking, I don't think he wanted to talk, to tell you the truth.
Which
I don't
think
he wanted to show his emotion.
Yeah, which is probably fair enough.
The man I know.
Manila Times obviously went at the ninth fence. There'd been so much focus as well on Snow Leopardess was pulled up kind of midway round. Anything else in particular stand out for you in terms of performances, people that maybe...
No, Delta Work on the cracker, 1-2-3 for Ireland again in the Grand National. And look, you say it again, but look, it's not that long ago, Damien, Bobby Joe in 99 was the first Irish winner since Lascargo in the mid-70s. And now to the strength and dominance of Irish National Hunt racing at the moment. It won't last forever. I hope people are enjoying it. But it was great to see an Irish 1-2-3 again in such a big race.
How different is Aintree as a festival from the other ones? I don't even want to say the misfortune. I was in Liverpool for a match one weekend, and it was the weekend of the Aintree Festival, and I ended up there on the Friday. And I swear to God, I have never seen carnage the like of which was unfolding. To my uneducated eye, it seems to be a different buzz around Aintree than it would around other places.
Yeah, it is, and it's probably one of the few racecourses in the world that's in a city that can cater for everybody who's attending. Like, even if you go to Cheltenham, Damien, Cheltenham's not that big a town. People are spread all over Gloucester trying to stay, so there's not the same congregation of people. As a festival, it is a really good festival. It's not Cheltenham. It's centred around one race. There's only one race at Aintree that will change your life, and that's the Grand National, where there are several races at Cheltenham that could define your career.
OK, let's get stuck into the golf. Masters weekend, Gary Murphy is with us. Gary, how are you?
I'm very well, Damien, yourself?
Not too bad. Good to talk to you. Long time no speak.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. It's been a while.
It's been you never ring, you never text. You know, we must reacquaint.
They've got the old band back together tonight, Emmy.
There you go. Come here. We were chatting about it there at the outset. It was one of those, like, the Masters, to win the Masters is always special. It's interesting. All the years say that Tiger had a procession to victory. Nobody ever seemed to suggest it was like an underwhelming climax to the Masters. There seems to be a little bit of criticism, or certainly analysis around that from an American's perspective this week. But I suppose Rory and Shane, as Ruby touched upon at the start of the programme, really kept the interest high from an Irish perspective late last night.
They did. I think, you know, McIlroy's final round was remarkable considering, you know, he was out of sorts first three rounds. Didn't really... you know, he's got a problem in first rounds of majors. He's shooting himself out of tournaments before they even start, almost. But his performance last night was phenomenal. Now, I don't know, was Scheffler... I think Cameron Smith's triple on 12 took all the pressure off Scheffler to, you know, to be stood on that 13th tee, knowing that kind of 7 under was in the house as such, would have helped him, but... If he hadn't been going for his first major, there would have, you know, been even less. You know, people might have switched off, but they were kind of hoping against hope from an Irish point of view that maybe the Grand Slam was a possibility. But, you know, Scheffler is the best player in the world at the moment. That's his fourth win in 6 starts. And, you know, outside of Tiger, I can't remember anyone doing that.
Yeah,
he won three tournaments before he got here, and then he wins the first major of the year. So he's... he's an outstanding talent, and showed, you know, because he looked a little edgy at the start, and, you know, it looked like, obviously 3 was a huge break, but he's a worthy champion, and, you know, he didn't really win by 3, he won by 5. He was just having a little jig on 18, I think, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that in my life, but it was a dominant win, and he has been very dominant for the last 2 months.
Do you think he got a break on three, Gary, or did he mean to play it into the upslope of the green?
Oh, no, he was trying to kill it into the bank. He just hit it too hard and obviously hit the flag and in it goes, happy days. That was kind of the only shot he had, but, you know, I think his composure is remarkable. Like that pitch he hit on the first, you know, that's like chipping it down the stairs, really, without the carpet on it. And for him to get it down stone dead, you know, but he missed his drive left. He missed his drive left on three. He was in trouble, so he was a little rattled. But he, you know, even the par putt on 11 was huge. And then he just seems to have a knack of kind of hitting the right bad shot. You know, even on 12, when Smith went in the water and the pressure was massively on to not do the same thing, and he just hoiked it way left. But, you know, he got a little bit of luck too, because you have to have luck to win things. There's no denying that. But just his pitch and putt there was tremendous. He just did everything right when he had to do it. And, you know, even on 15 with that four-shot lead to go with the green and two, just shows that, you know, he's a confident young man, and he's not a charismatic superstar type of number one that, you know, any sport would hope for, but you can only judge these guys on the performances, and he's the best player in the world by a stretch at the moment.
So, Gary, how does Rory McIlroy find a way to start a tournament with the imagination that he had yesterday?
Well, it was different yesterday, Ruby, and the conditions were much easier, so it's easier for him to kind of freewheel it and play his own game. It was very difficult the first three rounds with the wind and the cold air, whereas you feel like you're just kind of chipping the ball around. It's very hard to get a flow. But I don't know. I wish I knew the answer. He, you know, was so exciting last night making that charge. The problem with the mindset, I guess, is, you know, he alluded in his first two rounds that he was happy with his performance because he was trying not to play himself out of the tournament. But the problem was that Scotty Scheffler was playing phenomenal golf, and he had a five-shot lead on the field through 36 holes. So Scheffler has gone out with an aggressive attitude. Maybe at the PGA next month, if he just tries to go out and be aggressive in the first round. But the problem, the greatness of yesterday was there was no mistakes in it. It's very hard not to make mistakes. He's had plenty of rounds where he's had 5, 6, 7 birdies, but he's mixed it up with the same amount of bogeys. So at this stage, he's probably trying everything. But it looks like at the moment, his best chance of winning a major has kind of been maybe 3 or 4 back coming final round, and he can have a charge at it. But it's, he can still take a lot away from it, but he really needs to be a lot more ruthless, I think, in his early rounds and try to get the lead and maintain that ruthlessness for 4 days. But it's very hard when you're getting nervous too, because you get protective. So he needs to find that balance. But it was just brilliant to see him in full flow last night.
When he walked off 13, what were you thinking he was going to score?
I thought if he got to 8... But, you know, maybe. But Scheffler was never going to choke it. That was McIlroy's problem. I think that was all their problems, really. I was shocked that Smith... I know he's finished second on paper, but it's a distant second, really. And, you know, at the end, he's scrambling. He had to get up and down on 17, and he holds a ridiculous shot out of the bunker on the last. So, whilst it's a brilliant second-place finish on paper, realistically, I don't think he ever had a chance to win it.
Yeah, it was a free pass in many ways. Just a word on Shane. If there's a criticism of Shane over the weekend, is it that he nearly wants this too much? And did that affect him at certain points, particularly, like, there's so much focus on this supposed spat between himself and Bo on the 13th on Saturday, which I think has been completely blown out of proportion.
But it has, yeah.
It demonstrates what this means to him. And maybe, is there a psychological aspect to how he needs to approach it, likewise to how Rory needs to approach those early rounds?
I don't think so from Shane's point of view. You know, because it's very, even though he has won a major championship, I think it's, you know, he hasn't been a consistent top 15, top 10 player in the world. So it's a bit harsh to judge him on winning majors. I think if he could pick off one, you know, another major would be a phenomenal achievement. But it's his best ever performance there, and I think he showed a lot of really good stuff yesterday. You know, four was a disaster. It was just a bad shot, and he got the maximum penalty on it. But to come back from a triple bogey, you know, when realistically he was playing for second yesterday, he knew that Smith and Scheffler were going to be very difficult to catch, I think. You know, you might catch one of them, which he did with Smith, but the chances of catching both. But, I think it was an excellent performance from Larry. And he's playing the golf of his life at the moment, and he's on to Harbortown this week, which he likes a lot. So, you know, it's an exciting time for Larry. He's back up to 30 in the world rankings. And it's another, you know, it's two top fives now in his last, what, four majors. So he's getting back to being comfortable, I think, because there had to be a time of calibration after becoming a major champion, which he might have struggled a bit, little bit in 2020. I know it was a difficult year with COVID, but he's back to playing the golf he was playing pre-Portrush, and obviously in Portrush in 2019, and hopefully he can keep the foot down for the remainder of the season.
It would be great to see. But Seamus Power had a good weekend as well. Gary finishing 27, got himself over 100,000 and a good first Masters experience.
Yeah, it was his first major, so to start your first major at Augusta, which is the creme de la creme, and as you say, you know, to have an excellent week, and you know, he's what, 18th on the FedEx. Like, he's having a phenomenal season, and he's where he belongs, and that's what people need to recognise and support him. You know, there has been a thing a little bit with Seamus that we kind of don't know him, and he's the Irish American. He's as proud an Irishman as you can get, and we're obviously thrilled to have him at the K Club. He's a great ambassador for Ireland. And he's, you know, he's comfortably in the upper echelons of the sport at the moment. And he proved that at the weekend. Very solid first major appearance.
And obviously, Cam Smith going for that shot on the 13th, I think it was, with the triple bogey. When he started to melt there, did you think he could just completely fall out of the competition? Were you surprised to see him battle back the tie with Shane?
He's a tough cookie, Ruby, and I'm not surprised that he hung in there. I'm sure he was absolutely devastated after that triple on 12. I couldn't believe he did it, to be honest. I mean, he's such a good iron player, but I just think the fact that he bogeyed 11, he was trying to get some bit of squeeze out of Scheffler and went for the shot, and obviously didn't have the right contact. But you have to admire him for doing that. You know, he hasn't won a major yet, I'm sure. He will win one shortly, but I couldn't believe he hit that shot. But you have to at least commend him for having a go, because he had to try ruffle Scheffler, and it just didn't come off. And that's the nature of high-end sport.
Just to finish on the inevitable question about Tiger, can you ever conceivably see him win his 16th? Because let's be honest, none of us saw him making it through this weekend.
No, I don't think so. It's just sad to see him yesterday. Like, he was doubled over, really, wasn't he, coming off the 18th green? And the further he got to the closer he got to the clubhouse, the further he probably thought he was out of camera shot. And even you saw his leg wobbling and stuff. How he got around to make the cut was an incredible achievement. And the problem is, he's finished so far behind the winner. He's not going to be turning up just to play as a ceremonial. Now, he said he's going to play in the Open, and listen, if it gets fast and bouncy and hopefully it's warm at St Andrews, you never know with him. But he's a long road to physically just get back to where he wants to, never mind golf.
Okay. Gary, we'll leave it there. Good to talk to you as always. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Damien. Thanks,
Gary Murphy with us there. We've got much more to come in the programme. We're going to chat rugby with Stephen Ferris after the break, and we've got soccer to come with Alan Colley as well. Stay with us.
RTE 2FM. On 2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now.
Game on.
Rugby.
Welcome back to Game On. So last weekend did see the first round of the last 16 in the Champions Cup. Well, first leg of it anyway. And Stephen Ferris joins us on the line. But Stephen, we're going to start with the announcement of Graham Rowntree as the new Munster head coach. You played under him, well, briefly, on a Lions tour in 2019. He was part of that coaching ticket, so he's a man you know.
Yeah, he is. Thanks for that, Ruby. Driving the knife in there, saying briefly in 2009.
Well, you weren't there that long, like, were you?
Something about you, you're like me, you're just honest, fair play. So, I totally agree with you. I think he's a good appointment. I heard during the week there that Vern Cotter's name was in the hat and that he was definitely going to be in the mix for the job. And I thought that was a little bit of a surprise. He's obviously jumped around a few clubs, and obviously there's been a lot of Munster faithful been wanting Graham Rowntree to take the job. He seems to be the type of fella, I know we've chatted before on the show about him going to local club matches, really getting into the local communities and going out and watching a lot of young lads play rugby. And, you know, I think that's really appreciated down in Munster as it is in all clubs. So, for me, it's the right decision. I think after a big result at the weekend where, you know, I fully expected Exeter to pull away, you know, 15, 20 points in the bag going over to Thomond Park this week. But fair play to Munster. Like, they shut up shop and held out for large parts. And, it's a really tight one getting into this weekend. So, no, I think a lot of Munster fans will be happy, Ruby.
They will be happy, but was it as much Exeter's indiscipline as Munster's grit?
Say that again, sorry?
Was it as much Exeter's indiscipline as it was Munster's grit?
Of course, Exeter came down to the 13 men. But, like, you just look at the players that Munster are missing. Like, you know, the playmaker in Joey Carberry, Coombs, who is arguably their best forward, ball-carrying forward. I know Kendallin's come in and done a great job in the back row. I think O'Donoghue's playing some of the best rugby of his career this season, and really unlucky not to get a shout in the international scene. But I thought Exeter would turn to their power a bit more, much more one out runners, just getting over the gain line, going around the corner, getting over the gain line, and they got away from that a little bit of time. So I expect them to pitch up this week in Thomond Park with a mentality to win the match, because I think Munster with a full house down in Thomond are going to be hard to beat.
They could be, but I thought Keith Earls is tacking right at the death on Woodburn. That could be the one, couldn't it?
Oh, it could, yeah. Like, how many times has Keith Earls been, talked about, big game-changing moments throughout his career? I caught up with him briefly over in Twickenham when Ireland obviously beat England over there only a number of weeks ago, and he was in really good form. You know, things, family seemed to be really good. He's obviously got his coffee business up and running. His wife is in a good place as well. He's actually making a few coffees, and he was in really good form, and I think that's shown in his rugby. Every time he takes the pitch, he doesn't let Munster down, does he? And even in a green jersey in recent years, he hasn't let Ireland down either. So, no, it's brilliant to see him going well, and him and Simon Zabo on the wings are always going to be a threat.
Stephen, just to move on to the other games, come here, we'll stick with your beloved Ulster. 26-20 winners over Toulouse, which on paper, had you offered them that in advance of the weekend, they'd have taken the arm off you, I would imagine. But looking at the landscape of the game, the early red card for Toulouse, the lead Ulster had, going down the stretch, will they feel slightly hard done by that they're not bringing a greater lead back to the Kingspan Saturday evening?
Yeah, Damien, I think you're absolutely bang on. Watching the game, it just felt like it was Ulster's to put a few more points on the scoreboard. There was lots of controversy around the Ballacoon intercept. Was he offside or not? I think Wayne Barnes actually refereed a very dominant display, especially over the red card decision. I'm sure you would agree. Telling the TMO that he didn't need any more information, and I thought he handled the game really well. If Ulster's line-out had functioned the way it has been all season, I think they really could have got a 15-point lead going for Toulouse travelling away from home this weekend to the Kingspan. But what a finish by Toulouse, and they nearly got themselves, well, they could have bloody won the match in the end, only for a bit of a fumble or two around the breakdown. So yeah, I expect Anton Dupont to have a much better game. He was good in small parts of it. I think he let himself down a couple of occasions as well, so he'll be looking to up the ante. And I think there's been a few reports coming out in the media straight after the game that they weren't happy with the referee's decisions, they weren't happy with some of the calls that went against them, and they're going to be looking for revenge.
But just like, obviously this is new territory for the competition, and it's new territory for the players. We don't have this dynamic of home and away legs and competitions all that often. Like, so much was made at the end of the Munster game about the momentum, albeit in defeat, that they might have taken from the Earls Farrell incident at the end of the game. Likewise, is the momentum with Ulster or Toulouse ahead of the weekend? Ulster lead on points, but the way Toulouse finished and got themselves back into the game.
Yeah, I don't know about you lads, but I actually love the format.
That's brilliant.
I think it's brilliant getting into this weekend. Lots of anticipation to see what happens. You know, Toulouse know they have to come to Belfast and win by more than six. No team has come to Belfast this whole season in any competition and got a result. So are the reigning European champions going to be able to do it? Well, if they keep 15 men on the pitch, I really expect them to give Ulster a game. I thought the 2 second rows for Toulouse were brilliant. And I have to agree, I think the momentum is with them. They finished the game stronger. I think the Ulster side, they need to sort their line out. They need to get a bit more parity around the set piece, because they did get dominated at the times. And Toulouse, they shot themselves in the foot. The amount of times they just threw that one extra pass, that extra offload that didn't need to be thrown. And I think they'll be trying to keep it a bit tighter and try and win that kicking battle a bit more, because down to 14 men, they really lost the backfield at times throughout the game. But as I said there, lads, absolutely love the format, and a couple of big clashes coming up this weekend now.
I love it too, as well. I love it as well, Fez. But looking at the Connacht Leinster game, it's going to be hard for Connacht going to the RDS or the Aviva? Aviva, five points behind Leinster. They probably would have needed it 5 or 10 the other way, wouldn't they?
and the start that they get off to, I was watching it and listening to the commentary team, and everybody was buzzing. The atmosphere that was electric. The weather was obviously very good, and then all of a sudden, it just felt like Leinster just went up a couple of gears and held onto the ball for large parts. And the next thing there, what is it, a 10-12 point lead they got on the scoreboard. I think Jack Carty's struggling to perform a little bit again. He just seems to be in and out of games. Leinster won the kicking battle as well for big moments in that game. And I think there's a lot of Leinster fans out there. I think they're going to put 20 or 30 points on Connacht this weekend, but the Connacht lads will believe in themselves. They've turned Leinster over before on home soil, so why can't they do it again? But they're going to have to be much more accurate. They're going to have to get their scrum sorted out, because it got destroyed a couple of times. Luckily, Finlay Whelan didn't get a yellow card when I can't remember who was, went over in the corner in the second half. So lots to work on for Connacht, but here, you never know. The way this competition throws up surprises, you just never know.
I know safety is paramount in all sports, and the red card in the Toulouse Ulster game was a no-brainer, but I felt Jameson Gibbison Park was hard done by with his yellow against Connacht and Leinster. He was standing back out of the tackle. I know it was head to head, but somewhere along the way, Stephen, there's going to be clashes of heads that are just unavoidable.
Yeah, and like I mentioned at the URC there a couple of weeks ago, Kieran Treadwell won. For me, his shoulder hit the ball, and then there was a bit of a ricochet, and his jersey touched one of the lads' faces, for the Saffron guy's faces. And if you freeze frame everything, Ruby, every rock, every breakdown, there's contact to the head, to the chin, to the face, whatever you want. You cannot freeze frame everything. And I think it was a penalty. Yes, he was high to be yellow carded. He sort of absorbed the tackle. Again, I thought Ben Kay on commentary, I think it was Tricko as well, they thought it was pretty bad. Live there, obviously, Marmion with the busted nose doesn't help things. But as you touched on there, Ruby, if you're going to analyse every single collision that there is, you just look at the breakdown. Every single breakdown, there's nearly a neck roll, coming in slightly at the side. We talked about the Devon Toner one in at the side that injured Gavin Coombs. You just kind of got to let the game flow quite a lot. And just to go back to the Ulster game at the weekend with Wayne Barnes, there were so many counter rocks that were, you could have penalised the opposition for being off their feet a few times, but you got to positive play. You've got to get behind it, and I think the referees have got to take a look at it and just get more consistency around the high tackle. But if anything, lads are just going to have to tackle lower, because these yellow and red cards are being handed out week in and week out.
But Stephen, is there an issue as well around the dynamic that exists between the TMO and the referee, and ultimately who's the decision maker? You talk there about Barnes was decisive. Barnes was the man that was in charge at the weekend, and for all that people might have had criticism of Nigel Owens over the years, you knew that he wasn't a man for swaying. Look at the situation yesterday, the women's game in Cork. Amy Lee Murphy-Crowe had a try call back that nobody in the ground could really see, where a tackle was made that she, And I think in that situation, the TMO, I think, was trying to lead the referee to a different decision. But that seems to be as big an issue now about, it's like, you know, it's almost like Chinese democracy. We will keep giving you certain directions from the TMO truck until the referee makes the decision that the TMO thinks they should make. You know, do you know where I'm coming from? Is there a power shift dynamic that needs to be resolved as well?
So what's the point in having a TMO if the referee can see it in the big screen and see exactly what the TMO's saying?
Yeah.
This is what I don't understand. What is the point? Is the TMO there just to get a few things that the referee might miss on the hop because the referee's so involved in the game and, you know, it can't see every single decision? And I think that's fair enough. I think, you know, if there's a late hit that the referee's back is turned, then okay, turn it over. But you're right about the decisions, because over in South Africa, last minute, Callum Reid, loose head prop, apparently there was a knock on, TMO was trying to sway the referee into looking at it again, and he sort of, every time the referee asked a question, he didn't give him a straight answer. And you got to be decisive, and I think that's something I really admired about, you know, Wayne Barnes at the weekend, as much as we have a love-hate relationship, that he was very decisive. He says, look, I don't need you anymore, I've made my mind up, thank you very much, look, I don't need you anymore, I've made my mind up, and that's what we need more of. So for me, a TMO is there to pick up instances that occur where the referee doesn't see it, and just leave the referee to make the rest, because he can see it on the big screen, and he's got touch judges there as well that are able to help him out on the pitch.
I think you might have been happy enough if he went back for Dupont's knock-on, though.
But, like, if the try hadn't been given and it was shown on a replay the next day on social media that there was a knock on, I'd be like, well, you know what, it was missed. It happens in rugby, it happens every single week when club sides are playing, there's, you know, things are going to be missed. It was an unbelievable try. I was actually about to text a couple of my friends saying, did you see that try from Toulouse? And then I just didn't hit the send button and thankfully it was called back for a knock on by Dupont. But yeah, like, it's rugby, there's going to be, you know, refereeing decisions that go with you and against you, and I suppose even themselves out over the course of the season.
Can I just, before we finish and let you go, like, we look at it, Racing Stade Francais, 13-point deficit, could say that's done and dusted. Montpellier have 14 points over Harlequins. La Rochelle beating Bordeaux, who lead the top 14, 31-13. Now, obviously, there is a national fixation with Ronan O'Gara, and like, you know, you know him better than I do. There are not enough hours in the day for me to speak to Ronan and fully pick his brain to the extent that I would want to. But is he getting the credit as a head coach that he deserves for the work that he's done? Because I still think a lot of people see this kind of cranky, petulant fella who reveled in being seen as a cranky and petulant fella, but he's obviously, there's quite a rugby brain in there when you look at the trajectory of his career.
Yeah, like, I love the fella as a bloke. Like, he's a really top guy. In terms of his coaching ability and credentials, of, you know, how he's gone in the game, I've always told you in the story where I was on the train coming home from London, and next thing, the doors were just about to close on the train, beep 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 beep, and on jumps Ronan O'Gara, like, and he jumps on and the sweat's lashing off him, like, and I'm like, geez, Rog, what's the crack? Because how are you, Fez? I says, I'm not too bad, just got the bad news there, I'm having to hang up the boots, I've seen the specialist. And he says, all right, geez, sorry to hear about that, we had a bit of a yarn. I was like, what are you doing over here? And he says, I've signed with Racing 92 as defence coach or kicking coach. Like, he goes, I've no idea what the hell I'm doing, like, but I'm just going for it. And from then, like, he's just run with it. And I have huge admiration for him. He, you know, jumped in at the deep end, and he brought the family over to France. He, you know, he's really involved. He's done a fantastic job. I think all the lads love him. Does he get enough pats on the back from us over here? Maybe not. But, like, they were struggling at the start of the season. You know, we're still trying to get a few wins under their belt. I know that a couple of injuries, but, you know, when it comes to the big games and the big occasions, Ronan O'Gara's men seem to stand up, and, you know, fair play to them. I hope they keep bouncing on, because they're in good form at the minute.
Their offloading game was incredible to watch yesterday anyway. Stephen Ferris, thanks a million for taking our call. Damien, you were at the TikTok women's Six Nation match yesterday in Musgrave Park, where Ireland beat Italy 29-8 after two defeats against Wales and France. Greg McWilliams must have been happy.
Yeah, and I think there was a collective sense that they had targeted three home wins. Obviously, Wales are in a much different position this time around, that so many of their players have gone professional. I think there was a slightly unfair comparison drawn between the result last year where we hammered them and the result this year where they've effectively been full time. That said, Ireland led that game coming down the stretch and should have seen it home. You were never realistically going to beat France. Realistically, they're not going to beat England in 2 weeks' time. So it was a big one for them yesterday. The thing that blows me away, and I was doing the post-match interviews for television, and it's very difficult to do justice to just how loved and how invested people are in this team. And like, it got to the stage where some of the players would have been out on the pitch for an hour afterwards had you let them, greeting people. So there was a sense of, like, it's a rebuilding effort. They've not shied away from the fact that it's a rebuilding effort. I think, you know, I interviewed Bavan Parsons last week, has 17 caps. She was the fourth most capped player in the squad the week of the French game. So I think there was a sense for them that, you know, they've had the most traumatic of years with the failure to qualify for the World Cup, the independent report into the women's game, and I think they needed a win, and they got that win yesterday. The slightly unfortunate thing is you're now going to play England, who, like, are, you know, England will beat every team in the championship. They'll, you know, they're almost nailed on to win a Grand Slam. You know, that's going to be a difficult afternoon for Ireland. But you're missing the sevens players who are heading off to Canada in preparation for what is a sevens year. So you've played three games with one squad, and now you need to kind of tear it up because you're going to lose so many of them, which I think will make it difficult a few weeks ahead. But no, very, very enjoyable atmosphere, very loud atmosphere for 5,000 odd people down in Cork. So yeah, it was good fun to be there.
I'm sure it was, and hopefully they can continue to build on what they achieved yesterday. But we're going to take another quick break. We'll be back with Alan Cawley on the Premier League.
RTE 2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new added benefits range is enriched with all your B vitamins, which are essential for your health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on.
Football.
So the game in the Premier League took place yesterday afternoon, late in the afternoon, even at the Etihad Stadium. Alan Cawley joins us on the line. Manchester City versus Liverpool. It's in City's hands, but they've left themselves with no wiggle room, should they have?
Yeah, it was a brilliant game, Ruby. There was obviously so much hype going into this weekend's game, and people talking about the greatest rivalries ever, and are the two of the greatest teams we've seen in the Premier League and all this stuff. I just wanted to focus solely on the game in hand, and it didn't disappoint. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. The standards that both these teams are setting over the last 3-4 years has been absolutely phenomenal, and I suppose what we came away from the game showing really was just the fact that how closely matched they are, and obviously it was 2-2 in the end. I felt overall Man City were the better team. As you said, have they left them enough wriggle room? I'd say Pep was probably more disappointed than Klopp, because I felt they should have won it. Especially you look at the Sterling offside goal, it was a nostril really, in whether he was onside or not. And you look at the chance Mahrez had at the end as well, I thought he should have scored that as well. Rather than trying to chip the keeper, I thought he should have actually been more clinical and actually just had a good strike at it with the chance that he had. So I think over the course of the game, out of the two managers looking back on it today, I'd say Klopp was probably more happier than Guardiola. But as Guardiola said after the match, they're still on top of the league, they're still 1 point clear, it's still in their hands, 7 games to go. People are suggesting they have the better run in as well, but I think there'll be twists and turns yet.
The passing was incredible. Salah to Jota for the goal, Salah to Mane, De Bruyne to Mahrez at the end. Like, the vision of so many players on the pitch was a joy to watch.
Yeah, they're outstanding. It was a brilliant start on Match of the Day last night, because I obviously watched the game live yesterday. I watched it back again today. I watched Match of the Day last night, and it was a brilliant start about the two clubs basically have played 145 games now, I think it is, since 2018, and one have accumulated 389 points and the other is 388 points. And that just goes to show about the standards that they've been setting, and that we often say in here they could be on a eight winning match run and one of them has a draw, and we're suggesting it's a blip or whatever. You know, the standards that have been set have been absolutely phenomenal, and as you say, the quality that was on show as well, Ruby. And sometimes with these games that we've seen over the years, when the top two two maybe face off against each other. They can be cagey affairs. But I think with the approach that both these managers play week in, week out, I don't think any one of them was going to back down. They were going to, regardless of the fact that whether Liverpool were away from home or whether Man City were at home, it was the same approach no matter what. And I think that's what made it such a brilliant game, because both of them go out to attack and win the game, rather than sometimes, as you suggest, we watch teams and are basically playing not to lose.
But we made the point at the start of the programme that, you know, we are forced to endure this deluge of the Premier League being the greatest league in the world. Mm. And it's not. You know, OK, you're going to get two equally matched teams, might play out somewhat of an entertaining occasion. But the reminder yesterday was there that these two teams, savour them while they're here at the moment, because they are head and shoulders above everything else that exists within that league.
Yeah, absolutely, Damien. And I think, as I said, that stat that I've just pulled out, that Match of the Day showed last night, I think that's a clear indication of that, that for the last three or four seasons, the standards that they've been setting, not just in the Premier League, but in all competitions as well, they're going to face off in the Cup semi-final next weekend. There's a good chance they might face each other in the Champions League final also. So it's absolutely phenomenal. The two best managers, not only in the Premier League, I think they're the two best managers in the world at the moment as well, facing off against each other with two slightly different approaches. I felt, to be fair though, Guardiola, with the goals that they conceded, particularly the second one with Mane so soon after the break as well, if you look at Kyle Walker's starting position, and normally Kyle Walker's biggest strength is his recovery pace if he is caught out of position, and 9 times out of 10 against most of the opposition you play with in the Premier League, he'll get away with that and he'll recover. But just a split second that he was caught too far ahead, a brilliant pass, as Ruby said, from Salah to Mane, and a brilliant finish. And they're the fine margins as well, with both teams being so good at this level.
Here's one for both of you. Guardiola has said he will leave next summer, 2023. Mm. Klopp has said he will leave in 2024. Which of them is the harder one to replace?
Oh, that is tough. It's a question of whether to go, Damien. I know Guardiola is very, very intense. We've seen that with Barcelona, with the success that he had, and he felt as though he basically throws so much into it that he's all consumed. I'd say 24 hours a day he's non-stop, he never lets up. You see him on the line as well. I know Klopp is very passionate and energetic as well. I'm not sure if he's as consumed as Guardiola, in the sense that he might feel the need to take a break. But if you look at the two of them in terms of the level that they're at, and I suppose the scrutiny that's on them to win every week, and the pressure that's on them, why would you leave? Where would they go? Where would they go right now? You won't go to anyone better, I don't think.
No, they'll both go. But you have to remember one thing in life: there is nobody irreplaceable.
Yeah.
Sir Alex Ferguson looks irreplaceable at the moment.
But if you were...
So are half his team, Alan.
Yeah.
I mean, but look at the team of players he has. Yeah, but Sir Alex, that's rumbled on. We're not even going to talk about Man United. They don't deserve to be talked about, to tell you the truth. But no, the things move on.
I think Klopp is the harder to replace.
No, that is fair.
Klopp personifies everything that that club has become about. And if you look at Liverpool under Brendan Rodgers, and Liverpool, what the entire club represents under Klopp.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, as you say, Damien. Not just the impact that he's had at the club. I think the impact he's had on the city. You wouldn't get that with Guardiola in terms of Manchester, but I think the impact he's had on the people at Liverpool as well, and the regard he's held in. They're brilliant teams. You mentioned it a moment ago that we should kind of cherish the fact that we have these two teams facing off against each other in three competitions now, and they've already faced each other off in the final of the League Cup as well. So it's phenomenal, and the standards that they're setting is absolutely incredible.
So neither of you lads want to talk about United?
No, not worth talking about.
We talk about Everton and their great results.
Chelsea and Spurs, I'd say.
Yeah.
Well, here's one that links kind of towards Man United. You look at Conte, right? I have the height to respect for Gary Neville. You listen to Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher, in my opinion, they're the two best voices on the game. You tune in on Monday Night Football, it's brilliant watch, brilliant to listen to. But how Gary Neville has come to the conclusion that Antonio Conte wouldn't be a good fit for Man United is mind-boggling for me, Damien. And I think the point he's trying to make is the fact that Conte comes in, it's almost like the Davy Fitz thing here in hurling, that you get a bounce for a couple of years and that's it then. But I think if Conte was to manage Man United, it might be the opposite, that he actually might stick around there because of the stature of the club and the size of the club. But you look at the impact he's had at Spurs, and you look at them again at the weekend with Son and Kane, they're unbelievable. And just to change, the one thing that you look at Man United that they're crying out for, is a standard, and the demands that he sets on the players and the culture that he creates, that he doesn't tolerate anything but the highest of standards. That's the problem with Man United. There is no standard at the moment.
And let's be honest, if you were advising Eric Ten Hag, I have to get that name right because I fall over it every time, you would tell him to stay where you are for 12 months and take the Man City job instead if Pep goes in 12 months' time.
It's too big of a job. There's so much wrong that one man is not going to come in and fix it. Certainly not Ten Hag.
The other story of note from the weekend, Matt Doherty, who went from being the forgotten man at Spurs to being a central cog, being played out of position, admittedly, but like really seemed to buy into the Conte thing. Like, obviously bad injury at the weekend, and now you're hoping he's in a race against time to be fit for Ireland's games in the summer.
Yeah, it's a huge blow for him because he's had a difficult season, as you say. When Conte came in, everybody thought, even with Nuno, because he had managed him at Wolves, that he would play every week under Nuno. That wasn't the case. Then a new manager comes in, Conte, you're thinking he has a chance to obviously stake his claim, and he had to bide his time. I don't think Conte was having him in the early stages. They obviously paid money for Emerson Royale as well, so he was going to have to dislodge him. But he did bide his time, and when he got his opportunity, he took it in the last few weeks, and it's such a blow for him because he's been playing really, really well. And you look at since Conte come in, I think they've accumulated the highest points tally bar Man City and Liverpool. Have picked up 37 points, and he's played a huge part in that. Everybody will focus on Kane and Son and the boys at the top end of the pitch, and they're phenomenal. But Matt Doherty's had a huge impact in the last few weeks.
Alan, you're on Cork Comms tomorrow night for the Sweden versus the Republic of Ireland. Is live on RTE2 and Radio 1 Extra. Kickoff is at 5:30. Big game for Vera Powside.
Yeah, massive game, Ruby. They're obviously up against it. Sweden are the second best team in the world in the rankings. They've played 6 matches already, won 6, scored 26. They've only conceded 1. So that just gives you, I suppose, the task in hand for the girls. But they are playing out for that second place position with Finland. They've only played 4 games themselves, the Irish team, so they have a couple of games in hand. They've won on Finland, 2 on Sweden. But it's a huge game. I think if they can acquit themselves properly, be well organised, well structured, which they probably should be, to hell Sweden to a 1-0 defeat here in the corresponding fixture. So it's a big game, a tough game, Ruby, but I don't think this will define the group.
But you look at it, like Sweden beating Georgia 15-0, you know, like the disparity that exists within women's international football, that, let's be honest, Ireland have a game in hand. You're looking at beating Georgia in June, and you're looking at that game against Finland at the start of September. They're ultimately the games that will decide our qualification, that in a way, while you don't want to be humiliated and you want to win tomorrow, it's a relative free pass for the Irish tomorrow.
Yeah, I agree totally with that, Damien. You've already kind of outlined the fact that Sweden, in terms of the disparity between the other teams, winning 15-0. Now, we beat Georgia 11-0, but I was at that game, and yeah, it was a poor, I suppose, opposition, Georgia. But the game tomorrow night will certainly not define the group for them. And I don't think they'll be humiliated. I think, to be fair to Vera Powell, this team has been growing. They've been improving game on game. They're very well organised, very well structured. It will be a very, very difficult game for them. But I think they'll give a good account to themselves.
No chance of a draw then? Sneak a little nil-nil?
They might, Ruby, yeah. It's very hard to break down 10, 11 people behind the ball. So, as I say, if they're well organised, well structured, it was only 1-0 here in Tala. So who knows?
Who knows is right. Alan Cawley, thanks a million for taking the call. Damien O'Mara, I have really enjoyed your company. That's about all we have time for. Tara Kumar is up next, I do believe.
Yes,
we'll be back
yes,
tomorrow
indeed.
Evening.
Talk to you, Ruby. Good luck.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now.